My name is Dresden. I'm here to talk.
Silence. The snow started soaking through my shoes and my jeans. Thomas whipped his head around toward the end of the little street, where the subdivision ended and the woods that were next in line for the bulldozers began. He stared intently for a moment. It's in the trees, he reported quietly. The hair on the back of my neck stood up, and I hoped fervently that whatever was out there, it didn't have a gun.
I'm not here for trouble,
I called toward the house. I held up two fingers and said,
Scout's honor.
This time I saw the curtain twitch and caught a faint stir of motion behind it. The inner door to the house opened and a man's voice said,
Come in. Hands where I can see them.
I nodded at Thomas. He lifted his hand, holding his car key, and pointed it to the Hummer. It clunked and chirped, its doors locking. He came around the car, sword belt hanging over his shoulder, while I broke trail to the front porch, struggling through the snow. I knocked as much of the powder as I could off my lower body, using it as an excuse to give me time to ready my shield bracelet. I didn't particularly want to step through a dark doorway, presenting a shooting gallery profile to any gunman inside, without taking precautions. When I came in, I held my shield before me, silent and invisible.
Stop there, growled a man's voice. Staff down. Show your hands.
I leaned my staff against the wall and did so. I'd know those monosyllables anywhere. Hi, Hendrix. A massive man appeared from the dimness in the next room, holding a police-issue riot gun in hands that made it look like a child's toy. He was built like a bull, and you could apply thick and rock-like to just about everything in his anatomy, especially if you started with his skull. He came close enough to let me see his close-cropped red hair.
Dresden, step aside.
I did, and the shotgun was trained on my brother.
You, vampire, sword down, fingers laced behind your head.
Thomas rolled his eyes and complied. How come he doesn't have to put his hands behind his head?
Wouldn't make any difference with him, Hendrix replied.
Narrow, beady eyes swiveled like gun turrets back to me.
What do you want?
I wasn't sure I'd ever heard Hendrix speak a complete sentence, much less string phrases together. It was sort of disconcerting, the way it would be if Mister suddenly developed the capacity to open his own cans of cat food. It took me a second to get over the mental speed bump.
I said, I want to...
I realized how lame this was going to sound. I gritted my teeth and said it quickly.
I want to help your boss.
There was a clicking sound from the wall, the sound of an audio speaker popping to life. A woman's voice said,
Send the wizard up!
Hendrix growled.
Are you sure?
Do it. The vampire stays downstairs.
Hendrix grunted and tilted his head to the right.
Through there, and up the stairs, Dresden. Move it.
Harry, Thomas said quietly. Hendrix brought his shotgun back up and covered Thomas.
Not you, pretty boy. You stay put, or both of you get out.
It's okay, I said quietly to my brother. I feel better if someone I trust is watching the door anyway, just in case someone else shows up. I cast my eyes meaningfully in the direction of the woods where Thomas had said something lurked. He shook his head.
Whatever.
Then he leaned back against the wall, casual and relaxed, his hands behind his head as if they were only there to pillow his skull. I brushed past Hendrix. Without slowing down or looking behind me, I said,
Careful with that gun. He gets hurt and it's going to be bad for you, Hendrix.
Hendrix ignored me. I had a feeling it was his strongest conversational ploy. I went up the stairs, noting a couple of details as I went. First, that the carpet was even cheaper than mine, which made me feel more confident for some obscure reason. Second, that there were bloodstains on it. A lot of them. At the top of the stairs, I found more bloodstains, including a long smear along one wall. I followed them down to one of the three bedrooms on the upper level of the house. I paused and knocked on the door.
Come in, Dresden,
said a woman's voice. I came in. Miss Gard lay in bed. It had been hauled over to the window so that she could see out of it. She had a heavy assault rifle of a design I didn't recognize next to her. The wooden handle of a double-bladed battle axe leaned against the bed, within reach of her hand. Gard was blonde, tall, athletic, and while she wasn't precisely beautiful, she was a striking woman with clean-cut features, icy blue eyes, and an athlete's build. She was also a mess of blood. She was soaked in it. So was the bed beneath her. Her shirt was open, revealing a black athletic bra and a long wound that ran the width of her stomach, just below her belly button. Slick, gray-red ropey loops protruded slightly from the wound. My stomach twisted, and I looked away.
Goodness,
Miss Gard said, her voice quiet and rough, her face pale.
You'd think you never saw anyone disemboweled before.
Just relieved, I said. I forced myself to face her. First time today I've run into someone who looks worse than me. She showed me a weary smile for a moment. You need a doctor, I said. She shook her head.
No.
Yes, I said, you do. I'm surprised you haven't bled to death already. Think of what it would cost Monarch Securities to replace you.
They won't need to. I'll be fine. The company has a great healthcare package.
She picked up a small tube of what looked like heavy-duty modeling glue from the bed at her side.
This isn't the first time I've had my guts ripped out. It isn't fun, but I'll make it.
Damn, I said, genuinely impressed. Are they hiring? The question won another faint smile.
You don't really fit the employee profile.
I'm tired of being kept down by the man, I said. Gard shook her head wearily.
How did you find us?
Demeter, I said. She lifted a golden eyebrow.
I suppose that shouldn't surprise me, though I've warned him. He's too trusting.
Marcone is too trusting? I widened my eyes at her. Lady, that pretty much puts you in a paranoid league of your own.
It isn't paranoia, just practical experience. A safe house isn't safe if it isn't secret.
She reached down and pressed bloodied fingers against a loop of gore, gently kneading it back into the wound. She let out a hiss of pain as she did, but she didn't let a little thing like an exposed internal organ get in the way of conversation.
You threatened her?
Mostly I told her I'd help Marcone. She lifted the tube of airplane glue and smeared some of it onto either side of the wound where she'd pushed her guts back in. She bled a little more. I noticed that several inches of the wound had already been closed and sealed together.
You gave her your word?
Gard asked. Yeah, but I couldn't take it anymore. Look, could you maybe not do that while we talk? It sort of makes it hard for me to focus on the conversation. She pressed the edges of the wound together, letting out a breathy curse in a language I didn't know.
Did you know, she said, that this kind of glue was originally developed as an emergency battlefield suture?
Did you know that you're about to find out what I had for breakfast this morning? I countered.
I don't know if it's true, she continued. I saw it in a movie with, damn it, with werewolves.
She exhaled and drew her hands slowly from the wound. Another 2 or 3 inches of puckered flesh were now closed together. Gard looked awful, her face gray and lined with pain.
Why, Dresden? Why are you looking for Marcone?
The short version? It's my ass if I don't. She squinted at me.
It's personal?
Pretty much. I'll give you my word on it if you like. She shook her head.
It's not your word that I doubt. That's always been good.
She closed her eyes against the pain and panted for several seconds.
But I need something from you.
What?
The White Council,
she rasped.
I want you to call upon the White Council to recover Marcone.
I blinked at her. What? She grimaced and began packing another couple inches of intestine back into her abdomen.
The Accords have been breached. A challenge must be lodged. An emissary summoned. As a warden,
she gasped for a moment and then fumbled the glue into place.
You have the authority to call challenge.
Her fingers slipped and the wound sprang open again. She went white with pain.
Damn it, Sigrun,
I said, more appalled at her pain than her condition, and moved to help her.
Get your hands out of the way.
When she did, I managed to close the wound a little more, giving the sharp-smelling glue a chance to bond the flesh closed. She made an effort to smile at me.
We worked well together at the beer festival. You're a professional. I respect that.
I bet you say that to all the guys who glue your stomach back together.
Call the council,
Gard said.
Lodge the challenge.
I got a better idea, I said. Tell me where Marcone is. I'll go get him and bring him home, and this will all be over. She started pushing the next bit back in while I waited with the glue.
It isn't that simple. I don't know where he is.
I caught on. But you do know who took him?
Yes. Another signatory of the Accords, just as Marcone is now. I have no authority to challenge their actions, but you do. You may be able to force them into the light, bring the pressure of all the members of the Accords against them.
Oh, sure, I said, laying out more glue. The Council just loves it when one of their youngest members drags the entire organization into a fight that isn't their own.
You would know, wouldn't you? Guard rasped. It's not as though it would be the first time.
I held the wound together, waiting on the glue. I can't, I said quietly. She was breathing too quickly, too hard. I could barely keep the wound closed.
Whatever you say. After all, it's your ass on the line.
I grimaced and withdrew my fingers slowly, making sure the wound stayed closed. We'd gotten the last few inches, and the opening no longer gaped.
Can't deny that, I said.
Then I squinted at her. Who is it? I asked. Which signatory of the Accords swiped Marcone?
You've met them once already, Guard said.
From downstairs, Thomas suddenly shouted,
Harry!
I whirled toward the door in time for the window behind me to explode in a shower of glass. It jounced off my spell-layered leather duster, but I felt a pair of hot stings as bits of glass cut my neck and my ear. I tried to turn and had the impression of something coming at my face. I slapped it aside with my left hand even as I ducked, then hopped awkwardly back from the intruder. It landed in a crouch upon the bed, digging one foot into the helpless guard's wounded belly, a creature barely more than the size of a child. It was red and black, vaguely humanoid in shape, but covered in an insect's chitin. Its eyes were too large for its head, multifaceted, and its arms ended in the serrated clamps of a praying mantis. Membranous wings fluttered at its back, a low and maddening buzzing. And that wasn't the scary part. Its eyes gleamed with an inner fire, an orange-red glow. And immediately above the first set of eyes, another set, this one blazing with sickly green luminescence, blinked and focused independently of the first pair. A sigil of angelic script burned against the chitin of the insect thing's forehead. I suddenly wished very much that my staff wasn't 20 feet away and down a flight of stairs. It might as well have been on the moon for all the good it was going to do me. No sooner had that thought come out than the Knight of the Blackened Denarius opened its insectoid maw, let out a brassy wail of rage, and bounded at my face. Chapter 13. At one time in my life, a shape-shifted, demonically possessed maniac crashing through a window and trying to rip my face off would have come as an enormous and nasty surprise. But that time was pretty much in the past. I'd spent the last several years on the fringes of a supernatural war between the White Council of the Wizards and the Vampire Courts. In the most recent years, I'd gotten more directly involved. Wizards who go to a fight without getting their act together tend not to come home. Worse, the people depending on them for protection wind up getting hurt. The second most important rule of combat wizardry is a simple one. Don't let them touch you. Whether you're talking about vampires or ogres or some other kind of monstrous nasty, most of them can do hideous things to you if they get close enough to touch. As even a lesser member of the Gruff Clan had demonstrated on my nose the night before. The prime rule of combat wizardry is simple, too. Be prepared. Wizards can potentially wield tremendous power against just about anything that might come along if we're ready to handle it. The problem is that the things that come after us know that, too. So the favored tactic is the sudden ambush. Wizards might live a long time, but we aren't rend-proof. You have to think ahead in order to have enough time to act when the heat is on. I'd made myself ready, and taught young wizards with even less experience than me how to be ready too, for an occasion just such as this. The coil of steel chain in my coat pocket came out smoothly as I drew it, because I'd practiced the draw thousands of times, and I whipped one end at the mantis thing's face. It was faster than me, of course. They usually are. Those two clamps seized the end of the chain. The mantis's jaws clamped down on it, and the creature ripped the chain from my hands with a wrench of its head and upper body quicker than thought. That was a positive thing, really. The Mantis hadn't had time to notice two important details about the chain. First, that the whole thing was coated in copper. Second, that a standard electrical plug was attached to the other end. I flipped my fingers at the nearest wall outlet and barked,
"Galvanius!"
The plug shot toward the outlet like a striking snake and slammed home. The lights flickered and went dim. The Denarian hopped abruptly into the air and then came down thrashing and twitching madly. The electricity had forced the muscles in its jaws and clamps to contract, and it couldn't release the chain. Acrid smoke began to drift up from various points on its carapace.
"Wizard!"
Guard gasped. She gripped the wooden handle of her axe and tossed it weakly toward me. I heard shouting and the bellow of a shotgun coming from downstairs. It stayed in the background, unimportant information. Everything that mattered to me was nearly within an arm's length. The axe bounced and struck against my leg, but my duster prevented it from cutting into me. I picked up the axe. Christ, was it heavy. Hauled off and brought it straight down on the Denarian, as if I'd been splitting cordwood. The axe crunched home, sinking to the eye somewhere in the Denarian's thorax. The thing's convulsions ripped the weapon out of my hands, and the plug from the wall outlet. The Mantis's head whipped toward me, and it screamed again. It ripped out the axe and came to its feet in the same instant.
"Get clear!"
Guard rasped. I did, diving to the side and going prone. The wounded woman emptied her assault rifle into the Mantis in 2 or 3 seconds of howling thunder, shooting from the hip from about 3 feet away. Words cannot convey how messy that was. Suffice to say that it would probably cost more to remove the ichor stains than it would to strip and refinish the walls, the floor, and the ceiling. Guard gasped, and the empty rifle slid from her fingers. She shuddered and pressed her hands to her belly. I moved to her side and picked her up, trying not to strain her stomach. She was heavy, not like a sumo wrestler or anything, but she was 6 feet tall in her bare feet and had more than the usual amount of muscle. She felt at least as heavy as Thomas. I grunted with effort, got her settled, and started for the door. Guard let out a croaking little whimper, and more blood welled from her injury. Faint pangs of sympathetic pain flickered through my own belly. Her eyes had rolled back in her head. It had taken a lot to beat Guard's apparent pain threshold, but it looked like the visit from the Denarian and the activity it had forced on her had done it. The day just couldn't have gotten any more disturbing. Until the splattered mass that had been the Denarian started quivering and moving.
"Oh, you have got to be kidding me," I shouted.
Where there had been one big bug thing, now there were thousands of little mantis-like creatures. They all began bounding toward the center of the room, piling up into two mounds that gradually began to take on the shape of insectoid legs. The shotgun downstairs roared again, and running footsteps approached.
"Hurry!"
Thomas shouted. He appeared at the bottom of the stairs, sword in hand, just as I hurried out the door, still toting Guard.
"We had company up here,"
I called. I started down the stairs as quickly and carefully as I could. "I think there are three more of them down here," Thomas said, making way for me. He took note of Guard. Holy crap. A corpse lay on the floor of the entry hall. It was black and furry and big, and I couldn't tell much more about it than that. The top 4/5 of its head were gone, and presumably accounted for the mess all over the opposite wall. Its guts were spilled out on either side of its body, steaming in the cold air drifting through the shattered front door. Hendricks crouched in the shadowed living room, covering the entryway with his shotgun. Something scraped over the floorboards of the ceiling above us.
"What's that?"
Thomas asked.
"A giant praying mantis demon dragging itself over the floor,"
Thomas blinked at me.
"That's just a guess,"
I said. Hendricks growled.
"How is she?"
"Not good," I said. "This is a bad spot to be in. No defenses here. Not even a threshold to work with. We need to bail."
"Shouldn't move her,"
Hendricks said.
"It could kill her."
"Not moving her will kill her," I countered. "Us too." Hendricks stared at me, but he didn't argue. Thomas was already reaching into his pocket. He was tense, his eyes flicking restlessly, maybe in an attempt to track things that he could hear moving around outside. He dug out his key ring and held it with his teeth. Then he took a saber in one hand, that monster desert eagle in the other, and started humming, "Froggy Went A-Courting," under his breath. Guard had slowly grown limp, and her head lolled bonelessly. I was having trouble keeping her steady.
Hendricks, I said, nodding at guard.
Without a word, he set the shotgun aside and took the woman from me. I saw his eyes as he did, touched with worry and fear, and not for himself. He took her very gently, something I would never have imagined him doing, and growled,
How do I know you won't leave us behind? Let them rip us apart while you run.
You don't, I said curtly, picking up my staff. Stay if you want. These things will kill you both, I guarantee it. Or you take a chance with us. Your call.
Hendricks glared at me for a moment, but when he glanced down at the unconscious woman in his arms, the rocky scowl faded. He nodded once.
Harry, Thomas asked, how do you want to do this?
We head straight for your oil tanker, I said. Shortest route between two points and all.
They'll have the door covered, Thomas said.
I hope so.
Okay, he said, rolling his eyes. As long as there's a plan.
Footsteps crossed the floor above us and paused at the top of the stairs. Thomas's gun swiveled toward the stairs. I didn't turn. I covered the doorway. A voice like out-of-tune violin strings stroked by a rotting cobra hide drifted down the stairs.
Wizard.
I hear you, I said.
This situation might be resolved without further conflict. Are you willing to parley?
Why not?
I answered. I didn't turn away from the door.
Have I your word of safe passage?
You do.
Then you have mine,
the voice answered.
Whatever, I said.
I lowered my voice to an almost subvocal whisper I was sure only Thomas could hear.
Watch them. They'll try something the second they get a chance. Why give them the opportunity? Thomas murmured.
Because we might find out something important by talking. It's harder to question corpses. Switch with me. We traded places, and I kept my staff pointed at the stairs as the mantis thing came down them. It crouched on the topmost step it could occupy while still maintaining visual contact with the entry hall. It looked none the worse for wear for being blown to hamburger by guard's rifle. It crouched, the motion eerie and alien, and tilted its head almost entirely to the horizontal, first one way, then the other, as it looked at us. Then its stomach heaved. For a second I thought it was throwing up, as a yellow and pink mucus began to emerge from its mouth. After a second, though, it lifted its clamp-like claws and gripped its head, then peeled it back and away from the mucus, the motion disturbingly akin to someone donning a too small turtleneck sweater. A human face emerged from the mucus and gunk, while the split carapace of the head flopped about on his chest and upper back. The Denarian looked like she was about 15 years old, except for her hair, which was silvery gray, short, and plastered to her skull. She had huge and gorgeous green eyes, a heart-shaped face, and a delicate, pointy chin. Her skin was pale and clear, her cheekbones high, her features lovely and symmetrical. The second set of green eyes and the sigil of angelic script still glowed faintly on her forehead. She smiled slowly.
I wasn't expecting the chain. I thought fire and force were your weapons of choice.
You were standing on top of someone I knew, I said. I didn't feel like burning her or blasting her through the wall.
Foolish, the girl murmured.
I'm still here.
But so am I.
You have 5 seconds to get to the fucking point, I said. I'm not going to let you stall while your buddies get into position.
Mantis girl narrowed her eyes. The eyes on her forehead narrowed as well. Trey, creepy.
She nodded at Hendricks and guard.
My business is with them, not you, O Warden of the White Council. Give them to me. You may leave in peace. Once they are dead, I will gather my compatriots, and we will depart the city without harm to any innocents. I grunted.
What if I need them alive?
If you wish, I can wait until you have interrogated them.
Yeah, that's what I want. You standing around behind my back.
She lifted a talon. I give you my solemn word. No harm will come to you or your companion.
Tempting, I said.
Shall I add in material reward as well? Mantis girl asked. I'll pay you 200,000 in cash.
Why on earth would you do that?
She shrugged a shoulder. My quarrel is with the upstart baron and his subjects, not the White Council. I would prefer to demonstrate my respect to your people, instead of causing an untoward altercation with them over the matter of your death.
Uh-huh. Her smile turned sharper.
If it pleases you, I might offer to entertain you once business is done.
I let out a harsh burst of laughter.
Ho, 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 I said, still chortling. Ho, 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 that's funny.
She blinked and stared at me, uncomprehending. The expression made me laugh even harder.
You want me to... I mean, hell's bells. You think I don't know what happens to a mantis's mate once the deed is done?
She bared her teeth in sudden anger. They were shiny and black.
You want me to trust you, I went on, still laughing. And do you think waving some bling and some booty at me is going to get it done? God, that's so cute. I could just put you in my pocket.
Do not deny me what is mine, wizard, she snarled. I will have them. Make a pact with me. I will honor it.
Yeah, I said. I've seen the way you people honor your pacts. Let me make you a counteroffer. Give me Marcone, safe and whole, and get out of town, now, and I'll let you live.
Suppose your offer appeals. Why should I believe you would allow us to leave in peace?
I gave her a faint smile and quietly paraphrased a dead friend. Because I know what your word is worth, Denarian, and you know the worth of mine. She stared at me for a moment. Then she said,
I will consult my companions and return in 5 minutes.
I bowed my head slightly to her. She returned the gesture and started up the stairs again. She vanished from sight. Glass broke somewhere upstairs. Then a red and black blur flashed down the stairs toward us simultaneously with a chorus of hellish cries from outside. Treachery doesn't work so well when the other guy expects it, and I'd had the spell ready to go since the second she'd turned her back. Mantis Girl didn't get to the bottom of the stairs before I pointed my staff at her and snarled,
Fusari!
A hammer of pure kinetic energy slammed against her. She went flying back the way she'd come, and when she'd reached the top of the stairs, she kept going, crashing through the wall of the house with a tremendous crunch. No time to lose. Something came charging through the doorway to be met by Thomas's sword and pistol. I didn't get a good look at it, but got an impression of spiraling antlers and green scales. I drew in my will, pointed my staff at the front wall of the house, and murmured, Fusare, sending out a slow pulse of motion. I let it press up against the front wall of the house, and then fed more energy into it, hardening it into a single striking surface. Then I drew back and really let loose, roaring,
Fusare!
At the top of my lungs. I unleashed everything I had into a blast of energy, which struck against the plate of force I just created. There was an enormous sound of screaming wood and steel, and the entire front wall of the house blasted free from its frame. Demonic voices howled. I turned to find Thomas taking advantage of the distraction to whip his saber through scything arcs, Rondello style, cutting his opponent to ribbons. The Denarian bounded away, screaming in brassy pain.
Damn it!
Thomas screamed at me.
That's a brand new car! Quit whining and go!
I shouted back, suiting words to action. The front wall of the house had come down like a tidal wave, shattering into a small ocean of rubble, covering the hood of the Hummer. Somewhere beneath the rubble, I could hear the other Denarians trying to get free. We rushed for the Hummer and piled in. Thomas got it started just as Mantis Girl sailed down from overhead and landed on the hood of the Hummer, denting it in sharply.
God damn it!
Thomas snarled. He slapped the Hummer into reverse and started driving backwards, while emptying his gun into Mantis Girl. Bursts of fluttering insect forms flew up from the gunshots, instead of sprays of blood, but judging by the screaming, it hurt her plenty. She tumbled back off the hood and vanished. Thomas manhandled the Hummer into a turn, and we left, heading back out into the heavy snowfall. We all rode in silence for several moments, while our heart rates slowed and the terror-fueled adrenaline rush faded. Then Thomas said,
I don't think we learned much.
Hell, we didn't, I said. Like what? We know that there are more than 5 Denarians in town, and we know that they're signatories of the Accords, who apparently object to Marcone's recent elevation. Thomas grunted acknowledgement. What now? I shook my head wearily. That last spell had been a doozy. Now, I think... I turned my head and studied the unconscious guard. I think I'd better call the council. Chapter 14. Now that I had not one but two supernatural hit squads with good reason to come after me, my options had grown sort of limited. In the end, there was really only one place I could take guard in Hendrix without endangering innocent lives. St. Mary of the Angels Church. Which was why I told Thomas to drive us to the Carpenter House. I still think this is a bad idea, Thomas said quietly. The plow trucks were working hard, but so far they'd barely been keeping even with the snow, ensuring that the routes to the hospitals were clear. The streets in some places looked like World War I trenches, snow piled up head high on either side. The Denarians know that we use the church as a safe house, I said. They'll be watching it. Thomas grunted and checked the rearview mirror. Guard was still unconscious, but breathing. Hendrix's eyes were shut, his mouth slightly open. I didn't blame him. I hadn't been standing watch over a wounded comrade all night, and I felt like I could have taken a nap, too. What were those things? Thomas asked. The Knights of the Blackened Denarius, I replied. You remember Michael's sword, the nail worked into the hilt? Sure, Thomas said. There are two others like it, I said. Three swords, three nails. Thomas's eyes widened for a moment. Wait, those nails? From the crucifixion? I nodded, pretty sure. And those things were what, Michael's opposite number? Yeah, each of those Denarian bozos has a silver coin. Three silver coins, Thomas said. I'm drawing a blank. 30, I corrected him. Thomas made a choking sound. 30? Potentially, but Michael and the others have several of them hidden away at the moment. 30 pieces of silver, Thomas said, understanding. I nodded. Each coin has the spirit of one of the fallen trapped inside. Whoever possesses one of the coins can draw upon the fallen angel's power. They use it to shapeshift into those forms you saw, heal wounds, all kinds of fun stuff. They tough? Certifiable nightmares, I said. A lot of them have been alive long enough to develop some serious talent for magic, too. Huh, Thomas said. The one who came through the door didn't seem like such a badass. Ugly, sure, but he wasn't Superman. Maybe you got lucky, I said. As long as they have the coins, hard to kill doesn't begin to describe it. Ah, Thomas said. That explains it, then. What? I asked. Thomas reached into his pants pocket and drew out a silver coin, a little larger than a nickel, blackened with age, except for the shape of a single sigil, shining cleanly through the tarnish. When I gutted Captain Ugly, this went flying out. Hell's bells, I spat, and flinched away from the coin. Thomas twitched in surprise, and the Hummer went into a slow slide on the snow. He turned into it and regained control of the vehicle without ever taking his eyes off me. Whoa, Harry! What? I pressed my side up against the door of the Hummer, getting as far as I physically could from the thing. Look, just don't move, all right? He arched an eyebrow. Okay, why not? Because if that thing touches your skin, you're screwed, I said. Shut up a second and let me think. The gloves. Thomas had been wearing gloves earlier when fingering Justine's scarf. He hadn't touched the coin with his skin, or he'd already know how much trouble he was in. Good. But the coin was a menace, and I strongly suspected that the entity trapped inside it might be able to influence the physical world around it in subtle ways, enough to go rolling away from its former owner, for example, or to somehow manipulate Thomas into dropping or misplacing it. Containment. It had to be contained. I fumbled at my pockets. The only container I was carrying was an old Crown Royal whiskey bag, the one that held my little set of gaming dice. I dumped them out into my pocket and opened the bag. I already had a glove on my left hand. My paw had recovered significantly from the horrible burns it had gotten several years before, but it still wasn't what you'd call pretty. I kept it covered, out of courtesy to everyone who might glance at it. I held the little bag open with two fingers of my left hand and said, "Put it in here, and for God's sake, don't drop it or touch me with it." Thomas's eyes widened further. He bit his lower lip and moved his hand very carefully until he could drop the inoffensive little disc into the Crown Royal bag. I jerked the drawstrings tight the second the coin was in and tied the bag shut. Then I slapped open the Hummer's ashtray, stuffed the bag inside, and slammed it closed again. Only then did I draw a slow breath and sag back down into my seat. Jesus, Thomas said quietly. He hesitated for a moment and then said, Harry, is it really that bad? It's worse, I said. but I can't think of any other precautions to take yet. What would have happened if I'd touched it? The fallen inside the coin would have invaded your consciousness, I said. It would offer you power, temptation. Once you gave in enough, it would own you. I've resisted temptation before, Harry. Not like this. I turned a frank gaze to him. It's a fallen angel, man. Thousands and thousands of years old. It knows how people think. It knows how to exploit them. His voice sharpened a little. I come from a family where everyone's an incubus or a succubus. I think I know a little something about temptation. Then you should know how they'd get you. I lowered my voice and said gently, it could give Justine back to you, Thomas. Let you touch her again. He stared at me for a second, a flicker of wild longing somewhere far back in his eyes. Then he turned his head slowly back to the road, his expression slipping into a neutral mask. Oh, he said quietly. After a moment, he said, we should probably get rid of the thing. We will, I said. The church has been up against the Denarians for a couple of thousand years. There are measures they can take. Thomas glanced down at the ashtray for a second, then dragged his eyes away and glowered at the dented hood of his Hummer. They couldn't have shown up 6 months ago, when I was driving a Buick. I snorted. As long as you got your priorities in order. I just met them, but already I hate these guys, Thomas said. But why are they here? Why now? Offhand, I'd say they were out to wax Marcone and prove to the other members of the Accords that vanilla mortals have no place among us weirdos. I mean, superhumans. They're members of the Accords? I'd have to look it up, I said. I doubt they're signed on as the Order of Demon-Possessed Psychotics, but from the way Mantis Girl was talking, yeah. Thomas shook his head. So what do they get out of it? What does taking Marcone prove? I shrugged. I'd already asked myself the same questions and hadn't been able to come up with any answers. No clue, I said. But they've got what it takes to have torn that building apart, and to get around or go through the kind of muscle Marcone keeps around him. And what the hell are the fairy queens doing getting involved? Thomas asked. I shrugged again. I'd already asked myself that too. I hate it when I have to answer my own questions like that. We went the rest of the way to Michael's place in gray and white silence. His street was on one of the routes being kept plowed, and we had no trouble rolling right up into his driveway. Michael himself was there with his two tallest sons, each of them wielding a snow shovel as they labored to clear the driveway and the sidewalk and the porch of the ongoing snow. Michael regarded the Hummer with pursed lips as Thomas pulled in. He said something to his sons that made them trade a look with each other, then hurry inside. Michael walked down the driveway to my side of the truck and looked at my brother, then at the passengers in the back seat. I rolled down the window. Hey, I said.
Harry, he said calmly. What are you doing here?
I just had a conversation with Praying Mantis Girl, I said. I held up a notebook where I'd scribbled down the angelic sigil while it still was fresh in my memory. Michael took a deep breath and grimaced. Then he nodded.
I had a feeling they might be in town.
Oh? I asked. The front door of the house opened, and a large, dark-skinned man appeared, dressed in blue jeans and a dark leather jacket. He wore a gym bag over one broad shoulder and had one hand resting casually inside it. He paced out into the cold and the snow, as if he'd been wearing full winter weather gear rather than casual traveling clothes, and stalked over toward us. Once he got close enough to make out the details, his face split into a broad, brief grin, and he hurried to stand beside Michael.
Harry!
He said, his voice deep, rich, and thick with a Russian accent.
We meet again.
I answered his grin.
Sonya,
I replied, offering my hand. He shook it with enough force to crack bones. What are you doing here?
Passing through,
Sonya said, and hooked a thumb up at the snow.
I was on the last flight in before they closed the airport. Looks like I'm staying for a few days.
His eyes went from my face to the notebook, and the pleasant expression on his dark face turned to a brief snarl.
Somebody you know? I asked.
Tessa,
he said.
And Inario.
You've met, huh?
His jaw clenched again.
Tessa's second recruited me. Tessa is here?
With friends.
I sketched the sigil I'd seen on the blackened denarius a few moments before and held it up to them. Sonya shook his head and glanced at Michael.
A carrier,
Michael said at once. I nodded.
He's in a Crown Royal bag in the ashtray.
Michael blinked. Sonya, too. I hope you have one of those holy hankies. I'd have taken it to Padre Fort Hill, but I figured they'd have him under observation. I need someplace quiet to hole up. Sonya and Michael traded a long, silent look. Sonya frowned, examining my brother.
Who is the vampire?
I felt Thomas stiffen in surprise. As a rule, even members of the supernatural world can't detect what a vampire of the White Court truly is, unless he's actually in the middle of doing something vampity. It's a natural camouflage for his kind, and they rely upon it every bit as much as a leopard does its spots. But it can be tough to hide things from a knight of the cross. Maybe it's part of the power they're given, or maybe it's just a part of the personality of the men chosen for the job. Don't ask me which. I'm fuzzy on the whole issue of faith and the Almighty, and I swim those waters with extreme caution and as much brevity as possible. I just know that the bad guys rarely get to sneak up on a knight of the cross, and that the knights have a propensity for bringing the truth to light. I met Sonya's gaze for a moment and said, "He's with me. He's also the reason the Cariel has a date with the inside of a vault." Sonya seemed to consider that for a moment. He glanced at Michael, who gave a grudging nod. The younger knight pursed his lips thoughtfully at that, his gaze moving to the back seat. Hendricks had woken up, but he hadn't moved. He watched Sonya with steady, beady eyes.
"The woman," Sonya said, frowning. "What is she?"
"Hurt," I said. Something like chagrin flickered over his features.
"Da, of course. You would not bring her here if you thought her a danger."
"Not to you or me," I said. "Tessa might have a different opinion." Sonya's eyebrows went up.
"Is that how she was wounded?"
"That was after she was wounded."
"Really?"
Sonya peered a little more closely at guard.
"Back off,"
Hendricks rumbled.
"Comrade."
Sonya flashed that swift smile again and displayed open palms to Hendricks. Michael nodded to Thomas. "Pull the truck around to the back of the house. With all this snow piled up, it should be hidden from the street."
"Thank you, Michael," I said.
He shook his head. "There's a heater in the workshop and a couple of folding cots. I'm not exposing the children to this."
"I understand."
"Do you?" Michael asked gently. He thumped the truck's dented hood once, lightly, and waved Thomas toward the back of the house. 20 minutes later, we were all warm, if a bit crowded, in Michael's workshop. Guard lay on a couch, sleeping, her color improving almost visibly. Hendricks sat down with his back to the wall beside Guard's cot, presumably to stand watch, but he started snoring within a few minutes. Sonya, with the help of Molly and her siblings, was off rounding up food. I watched as Michael wrapped a carryall up in a clean white hanky embroidered with a silver cross, muttering a prayer under his breath the whole while. Then he slipped the hanky into a plain wooden box, also adorned with a silver cross.
"Excuse me," he said. "I need to secure this."
"Where do they keep those things?" Thomas asked, after Michael had departed. I shrugged.
"Some big warehouse with a gazillion identical boxes, probably."
Thomas snorted.
"Don't even think it," I said. "It isn't worth it."
Thomas ran his gloved fingers over the white scarf.
"Isn't it?
You saw how these things operate. They'll manipulate your emotions and self-control, and something bad would happen to Justine. Or they'd wait until they had you hook, line, and sinker, and you were their meat puppet. And something bad would happen to Justine."
Thomas shrugged.
"I've got one demon in my head already. What's one more?"
I studied his profile.
"You've got one monster in your head already," I countered. "She barely survived it."
He was still for a moment. Then he slammed his elbow back against the workshop wall, a gesture of pure frustration. Wood splintered, and a little cold air whooshed in.
"Maybe you're right," he said in a dull voice.
"Holy crap," I said. An idea crystallized in my head, and a chill went down my spine. Thomas rubbed his elbow lightly.
"What?"
"I just had a really unpleasant thought." I gestured at Marcone's exhausted retainers. "I don't think that Anarians took Marcone so that they could erase him and make an example of him." My brother shrugged.
"Why else would they do it?"
I bit my lip, my stomach turning in uncomfortable flips.
"Because," I said, "maybe they want to recruit him."
Chapter 15. Thomas stood watch over our sleeping beauties while I went inside to talk with Michael and Sonya at the carpenter kitchen table. I laid all the cards down, see above regarding the general futility of lying to the Knights of the Cross, And besides, they'd both more than earned my trust. It didn't take me very long. So, I said, I think we gotta move fast and get Marcone away from them before he's forced to join up. Michael frowned and folded his broad, work-scarred hands on the table before him. What makes you think he's going to tell them no? Marcone's scum, I said, but he's his own scum. He doesn't work for anyone.
You are sure?
Sonya asked, frowning thoughtfully.
Yeah,
I said. I think that's why they wanted to grab Hendrix and guard instead of killing them. So they could force him to take the coin or they'd kill his people. Michael grunted. It's a frequently used tactic.
Not for Tessa, Sonya said, his voice absolutely certain. She prefers to find those already well-motivated to accept the coin. She regards their potential talents as a secondary factor to raw desire.
Michael acceded the point with a nod.
Which would mean that Tessa isn't giving the orders.
Sonya showed his teeth in a sudden fierce grin.
Nicodemus is here.
I started to swear, but I glanced at Michael and changed it to
fudgesicles.
Nicodemus nearly killed us all last time he was in town. And he did kill Shiro. Both of the knights nodded. Michael bowed his head and murmured a brief prayer.
Guys, I said, I know that your first instincts tend to be to stand watch against the knight, turning the other cheek and so on, but he's here with maybe twice the demon power he had on his last visit. If we wait for him to come to us, he'll tear us apart.
Agreed, Sonya said firmly. Take the initiative, find him, and hit the snake before he can coil to strike.
Michael shook his head.
Brother, you forget our purpose. We are not given our power so that we can strike down our enemies, no matter how much they might deserve it. Our purpose is to rescue the poor souls trapped by the fallen.
Nicodemus doesn't want to be rescued, I said. He's in full collaboration with his demon.
Which changes nothing about our duty, he said. Anyone, even Nicodemus, can seek redemption, no matter what they've done, as long as they have breath enough to ask forgiveness.
I don't suppose a pair of sucking chest wounds could get us around that,
I asked him.
Because if they would, I'd be tickled to provide them.
Sonya let out a bark of laughter. Michael smiled, but it was brief and strained.
My point is that we can undertake such an aggressive move in only the direst of circumstances.
Fairy stands poised on the brink of an internal war, I said, which would probably reignite the war between the Council and the Vampire Courts, and in the bad guy's favor, I might add. One of the most dangerous men I've ever known is about to have involuntary access to the knowledge and power of a fallen angel, which would give the Denarians access to major influence within the United States. Not to mention the serious personal consequences for me if they succeed in making it happen.
I looked back and forth between the two knights and held up one hand straight over my head.
I vote Dire. All in favor?
Michael caught Sonya's hand on the way up and pushed it gently back down to the table.
This isn't a democracy, Harry. We serve a king.
Sonya frowned for a moment, glancing at me, but then he settled back in his chair, a silent statement of support for Michael.
You want to talk to them? I asked Michael.
You've got to be kidding me.
I didn't say that, Michael replied.
But I will not set out to simply murder them and have done. It's a solution, Harry, but it isn't good enough.
I settled back in my chair and rubbed at my head with one hand. An ache was forming there. Okay, I said quietly, trying to make up a plan as I went along. What if I set up a talk? Could you be lurking nearby for backup?
Michael sighed.
There's a measure of sophistry in that. You know they'll try to betray you if it seems to be to their advantage.
Yeah. And it'll be their choice to do it. That's what you're looking for, isn't it?
Some way to deal with the problem while still giving them a choice about what to do? Preferably in some manner that will get as few good guys killed as possible?
He looked pained, but Michael nodded.
Fine, I said. I'll try to set it up.
How?
Sonya asked.
Let me worry about that,
I said. I checked the clock on the wall.
Crap.
I'm late for a meeting. Can I borrow your phone?
Of course, Michael said.
I glanced around the quiet house on my way to the phone and frowned.
Where is everyone? Charity took them elsewhere for a few days, Michael said. There won't be school in this mess anyway.
I grunted.
Where's Molly?
Michael paused and then shook his head. I'm not sure.
I don't think she went with them. I thought about it for a moment and thought I knew where she'd be. I nodded around the kitchen. How do you keep things running around here, with Molly under the roof? I figured things would be breaking down left and right.
Lots and lots of preventive maintenance, Michael replied steadily, and about twice as much repair work as I usually do.
Sorry.
He smiled. Small price. She's worth it.
The reasons I like Michael have nothing to do with swords and the smiting of evil.
I got on the phone and dialed McAnally's pub.
Mac,
answered Mac, the ever laconic owner.
It's Harry Dresden, I said. Is Sergeant Murphy there?
Mac grunted in the affirmative.
Put a beer on my tab and tell her I'm on the way?
Mac grunted yes again.
Thanks, man.
He hung up without saying goodbye. I made another call and spoke to a humorless-sounding man with a Slavic accent. I muttered my password so that no one in the kitchen would overhear it, but the connection was so bad that I wound up all but screaming it into the receiver. That kind of thing is to be expected when you've got wizards on both ends. It only took the jolly Northmen about 10 minutes to get my call through to my party.
Lucio, said a young woman's voice. What's gone wrong, Harry?
Hey, I protested. That's a hell of a thing to say to a man, Captain. Just because I'm calling in doesn't mean there's some kind of crisis.
Technically true, I suppose. Why are you calling?
Well, there's a crisis.
She made a sound.
A group known as the Knights of the Blackened Denarius has kidnapped Baron Marcone.
The crime lord you took it upon yourself to assist in joining the Accords? Lucio asked, amusement in her voice.
In what way is that relevant to the White Council?
These Denarius creeps are also signatories of the Accords, I said. Marcone's retainers are crying foul. They've asked me to formally protest the abduction and summon an emissary to resolve the dispute.
Seconds of silence ticked by. In what way, Lucio repeated, her voice much harder this time, is that relevant to the White Council?
The Accords don't mean anything if they aren't enforced and supported, I said. In the long run, it's in our own best interest to make sure they're supported now, before a precedent is set, and—
Don't bullshit me!
The captain of the wardens snarled, a hint of an Italian accent creeping into her speech.
If we take formal action, it could provoke a war we simply cannot afford. We all know the Red Court is only catching its breath. We can ill afford the losses we've already taken, much less those we might assume in the new conflict.
I made sure to keep my voice steady, grim. Mab has contacted me personally. She has indicated that it is strongly in our own best interests to intervene.
It wasn't exactly a lie. I hadn't ever specified who we meant. And with any luck, the mention of Mab would keep Lucio's attention completely.
The only reason the Red Court hadn't wiped us out in the years-long war was that Mab had given the Council right of way through the portions of the Never-Never under her control, allowing us wizards to stay as mobile as our opponents, who had considerably less difficulty employing mortal vehicles to maneuver its soldiery.
Jesu Christi, Lucio spat. She means to withdraw our right of way through winter if we don't accede to her demands.
Well, I said, she never actually came out and said that.
Of course she didn't. She never speaks plainly at all.
She does keep her deals, though, I pointed out.
She doesn't make deals she can't slide out of.
She's forbidden the ways to her people, but also to the Wild Fae as a gesture of courtesy. All she needs to do is relax her ban against the Wild Fae, and we'd be forced to travel in strength every time we went through the ways.
She's a sneaky bitch, I agreed. I crossed my fingers.
Lucio exhaled forcefully through her nose.
Very well. I will forward the appropriate notifications pending approval by the Senior Council. Which emissary would you prefer?
The Archive. We have a working relationship.
Lucio hmmed again.
I heard a pencil scratching.
Dresden, she said. I cannot stress to you enough how vital it is that we avoid general hostilities, even with a relatively small power.
Translation, don't start another war, Harry.
But, she continued, we can afford to lose the paths through winter even less.
Translation, unless you really have to. I hear you, I said. I'll do my best.
Do better, Lucio said, her tone blunt. There are those on the Senior Council who hold the opinion that we're already fighting one war because of your incompetence.
I felt heat flush up my neck. If they bring that up, remind them that my incompetence is the only reason they weren't all blasted to molecules by a newborn god, I shot back. And after that, remind them that because of my incompetence, we're enjoying a ceasefire that we desperately needed to replace our losses. And after that, that is enough, Warden, the captain snapped. I fought down my frustration and clamped my mouth shut. Hey, we were coming up on the holidays. They're a time of miracles. I'll notify you when I learn something, Lucio said, and hung up the phone. I hung up too, harder than I really needed to. I turned to find Michael and Sonia staring at me.
Harry? Michael said quietly.
That was Captain Lucio, was it not?
Yeah, I said.
You never told us that Mab threatened to go back on her bargain.
Well, no.
Michael watched me with troubled eyes. Because she didn't. You just lied to Lucio.
Yeah, I said shortly. Because I need the council's say-so to set up the meeting. Because I've got to set up the meeting so that the gang of murdering bastards who tortured Shiro to death will have a chance to prove to you that they still got it coming.
Harry, if the council learns that you've misled them,
they'll probably charge me with treason, I said.
Michael rose from his seat. But, I stabbed a finger at him, the longer we delay, the longer those creeps stay in town, the longer Summer's hitmen keep coming after me, and the more likely it is that innocent people are going to get hurt in the crossfire. I've got to move fast, and the best way to get the council to move is to let it think that its own ass is about to fall into the fire.
Harry, Michael began.
Don't, I said. Don't give me the speech about redemption and mercy and how everyone deserves a second chance. I'm all for doing the right thing, Michael. You know that, but this isn't the time.
Then what is right changes because we're in a hurry? He asked gently.
Even your book says there's a time for all things, I said. A time to heal and a time to kill.
Michael looked from me to the corner by the back door where the broadsword Amorakius rested in its humble leather scabbard, its plain crusader-style hilt bound in wire.
It isn't that, Harry. I've seen more of what they've done than you have. I have no qualms with fighting them, if it comes to that.
They've already blown up a building, tried to murder me, and set off a situation that nearly got your own children burned down in the crossfire. In what way has it not come to that?
Instead of answering, Michael shook his head, took up Amorakius, and walked further into the house. I scowled after him for a minute and muttered darkly under my breath.
You confused him, Sonia rumbled.
I glanced at the dark-skinned knight.
What? You confused him, Sonia repeated, because of what you did.
What? Lying to the council? I don't see that I had much choice.
But you did, Sonia said placidly.
He reached into the gym bag on the floor next to him and drew out a long saber, an old cavalry weapon, Esperacius. A nail worked into the hilt declared it a brother of Michael's sword. He started inspecting the blade.
You could have simply moved to attack them.
By myself? I'm bad, but I'm not that bad.
He's your friend. He would have come with you, you know that.
I shook my head.
He's my friend, period. You don't do that to your friends.
Precisely, Sonia said.
So instead, you have placed your own life in jeopardy in order to protect his beliefs. You risk your body to preserve his heart.
He brought out a smooth sharpening stone and began stropping the saber's blade.
I suppose he considers it a particularly messianic act.
That's not why I did it, I said.
Of course it isn't. He knows that. It isn't easy for him. Usually he's the one protecting another, willing to pay the price if he must.
I exhaled and glanced after Michael.
I don't know what else I could have done.
Duh, Sonia agreed. But he is still afraid for you.
He fell quiet for a moment while his stone slid along the sword's blade.
Mind if I ask you something? I said.
The big man kept sharpening the sword with a steady hand.
Not at all.
You looked a little tense when Tessa's name came up, I said.
Sonia glanced up at me for a second, his eyes shadowed and unreadable. He shrugged his shoulder and went back to his work.
She do you wrong? Barely ever noticed me, or spoke to me, Sonia said. To her, I was just an employee, one more face. She did not care who I was.
This second of hers, though, the one who recruited you. The muscles along his jawline twitched.